time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome back to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk about sleep and the science behind sleep. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today, our guest is Savannah Heitz. She's an LCSW. She works with insomnia, anxiety as primary areas in her therapy practice. She practices in New York, New Jersey, and Florida. Savannah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I love chatting all things sleep.
Great, great. Well, that's exactly the type of guest we want here, because that's what our audience is listening for. So, okay, there's several things I want to cover today. And I know that you've told me you do a lot of work with professionals of all different types of backgrounds. So it's going to be interesting to hear some of the stories that you have about things that people have dealt with. But I figured to get us started here today, why don't we talk about something that people might be surprised about to hear that impacts their sleep?
Yeah, this is a fun question because obviously there's many things that are surprising about sleep. Probably I could list 7 million things and you'd be like, oh, interesting, because it's just a cool topic. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I mentioned to people that they're like, oh, and they like didn't ever think about it is your eating. And I know the first thing that comes to your mind is, oh, yeah, I know I need to eat better or cut out sugar or whatever. But I'm really not even talking about the content of what you eat. I'm actually talking about timing.
When you say eating, I'm thinking, okay, she's going to tell us to eat turkey and tryptophan and these types of things. But I guess I'm wrong. So timing, that's the first that I'm hearing that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there's actually a whole field developing right now on like food and circadian rhythms and how they impact each other. Mm-hmm. But it's really similar to what your listeners might know about light intake or scheduled routine behavior. Like if you wake up at the same time every day, you're giving your circadian rhythm an indicator that, okay, it's morning time and mm-hmm. now it's time to feel alert. So your biological clock will send you signals saying, hey, be alert. And then when you are getting ready to go to bed, you have a routine and that helps your circadian rhythm to know it's bedtime and you start to get sleepy.
Right.
The same thing happens with your eating behavior. So if you are waking, obviously, if you're waking up at a significantly different time every day, your biological clock's going to be a little confused about right. what time is morning. Like, is morning 7? Is morning 11? Yeah. And then what does that mean bedtime is? With food, if you are sometimes having a 7 a.m. breakfast and sometimes having an 11 a.m. brunch and sometimes skipping breakfast altogether and doing like a 1:30 lunch, mm-hmm. your brain has no idea what that means about what time it is. And you're giving it really mixed signals.
Interesting. But that seems like a lot of people with their schedules of work, getting kids to school, shift work, you know, they just get stuck in crazy schedules like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a really kind of niche piece about this too, that a lot of people may not recognize, is the connection between like regular eating, even in our own like mental health. Mm-hmm. I have a history of working specifically with eating disorders and sleep dysregulation.
Okay.
And an eating disorder is a condition where someone is having a lot of disruption in their ability to perceive themselves, their body, and they have really distorted feelings and beliefs about their body. Mm-hmm. And it often drives them to significantly change the way they're eating, whether they're decreasing their caloric intake, whether they are skipping meals, whether they're significantly increasing how much they're eating, or doing other things like trying to get rid of their food in some way by exercising or other kind of purging behavior. Mm-hmm. So that's a really painful disorder to be experiencing. And oftentimes those people are trying to recover, but their sleep is completely disrupted, and that makes it really difficult for them to work through this eating disorder. They can't sleep, and that's making them feel exhausted. And of course, we all know when you're exhausted, it's going to be more challenging to handle things like anxiety, depression, right, trauma, any other mental health concerns.
Wow. Wow. So I realize there's a whole lot in there, and I know that there's a lot of different eating disorders, but just out of curiosity, with this new set of drugs that are out there for weight loss and all that, does that have any impact on what you're talking about also?
I'm sure it does, but the research is pretty new on it. There's actually a training I just recently only was able to attend for like 5 minutes, unfortunately. But there's a lot of new research and recommendations coming out because it's become so popular to abuse those medications for weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
Frustratingly, in the sleep field, and I'm sure you've experienced this as well, a common recommendation to people who are having trouble sleeping is to lose weight, right? Like, that's one of the first things your doctor will say to you if you can't sleep. And that's really difficult for the eating disorder field, because doctors recommending that you lose weight or eat less is going to have a huge impact on your mental health, and often will cause people to avoid going to the doctor because they feel that sense of judgment and bias against their body size, whether or not their eating behaviors are quote unquote healthy or unhealthy. So it kind of gets into this cycle where people are saying, hey, I can't sleep. And their doctor says, okay, well, instead of talking about that, let's talk about your body and your weight. And then the patient goes, ooh, that's not sitting right with me. I'm feeling very judged. I'm just not going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor loses the chance to talk with the patient through really healthy sleep behaviors and ways that they could improve their sleep, whether that's eating related or not. So there's a big thing happening here, I think, with the fields learning more about each other, both the nutrition field and the sleep field, and how they really should be working together.
Right, right. Wow. So when you talk about, you know, eating disorders and nutrition and things, are there particular things from a nutrition standpoint that people should be either working towards or avoiding? Or, you know, if someone is listening to this show, what should they be thinking about for themselves to do?
Mm-hmm. So I'm not a nutritionist, and I don't have the background to be able to speak to exactly, you know, what things you should be consuming.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think in terms of the mental health perspective that balance is a really important piece to be aware of. And when it comes to how sleep and eating impact each other, learning more about that and maybe starting to observe how your sleep and eating get connected and impact each other could be really helpful for you.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I've worked with people who will come in and say that they can't sleep, but then the more digging we do, we find that they're frequently skipping breakfast. And so that leads to that circadian misalignment, and they're not getting sleepy at the appropriate time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a million other things that also impact, like if you are not getting enough caloric intake during the day, there's actually chemicals in your brain that will send you messages during the night that promote wakefulness. These are called orexins. And these tell your brain, hey, you haven't had enough caloric intake today. You need to stay awake and go find some other food. It promotes food searching behavior. This is really helpful, to maintain our bodies and our health and maintain our life. But for someone maybe with an eating disorder, or maybe who's just chronically dieting, or who's been recommended to lose weight to promote their sleep, they're calorically restricting. And then in the middle of the night, their brain is telling them to wake up and go find food. And they have a sense of guilt about that. They're awake and they're thinking, oh, I'm so hungry. I wish I could have something. Or maybe they're like obsessively ruminating over what they ate that day and having a sense of guilt and shame about that.
Right.
And you and I know as sleep providers that when we are awake at night in our bed worrying, our brain is going to make a connection between the bed and the state of worry. And it's going to pair that arousal so that you start feeling alert and stressed just by the side of your bed because of how frequently you're awake worrying in your bed. And that's a unique way how food plays into that, that maybe you wouldn't expect.
Right, right. Okay, so, you know, I'm listening to what you're saying. And so a lot of this, when you talk about kind of like circadian rhythm and our body getting used to certain cues or triggers and not being hungry at night. So from that standpoint, we're saying that our food intake, our timing of our food intake, maybe even the amount of food of intake, that can have an impact on our sleep in several ways. I wonder, is there any information that you're aware of in reverse? Like if someone is having a sleeping problem, insomnia, for example, is that in reverse impacting their ability or desire to eat? Or is that not the way it works?
That's absolutely the way it works. Great, great catch there. So if you're experiencing insomnia, mm-hmm. you're likely going to be awake in the middle of the night. And there's probably going to be a sense of like, I'm so miserable that I'm awake. I want to do something to comfort myself, or I'm bored, or I'm trying to distract myself from the fact that I'm awake. So I might actually get up and eat a lot of food in the middle of the night for any of those reasons. And then by the morning, you get out of bed, no matter how you've slept. And usually you would eat breakfast, but because you had a lot during the night, you're not very hungry. Mm-hmm. So then it just goes back into further disrupting your circadian rhythm. But let's say that you start regularly skipping breakfast. And because of that, your body doesn't really have the caloric intake it needs to feel energized. So you're going to be even sleepier than you normally would be. Like insomnia aside, you're going to be really fatigued.
Right.
And that fatigue might cause you to start taking naps during the day.
Mm.
That might be because you're sleepy from not sleeping, but that also might be because you're calorically deficient.
Right.
So they're both, the insomnia frequently causes eating disturbance,
mm-hmm.
but eating disturbance also causes insomnia, and they just kind of cyclically impact each other in this way that makes us feel miserable and like, what am I supposed to be doing and how do I get out of this?
Right. Right. Well, it's also interesting, you know, as I've been doing this show, I've been getting more into, you know, we started off talking just about like traditional sleep disorders and things. But as I got into it, and as I learned more and more about sleep itself from my own practice, I realized that, you know, we are whole people, meaning that our sleep is one piece of it, but our sleep can be impacted by our diet. It can be impacted by our activity. It can be impacted by our social structure, all these things. And one of the areas when I've been looking at the diet part of it, I've been doing a lot of research related to sleep and dementia and whether mm-hmm. there's any, you know, connections there. And I've been reading several different books and things. And one of the things that I found pretty much consistently throughout all the books is when it comes to your food, as relates to, you know, avoiding, let's call it dementia and also your sleep, the American diet is not the ideal. So the heavy meats and heavy proteins and fatty things that we have and processed foods, they, you know, all the research shows that the more, you know, plant-based you can have, and I don't mean highly processed plant-based, I mean actual, like, you know, real plant-based, spinach, lettuce, kale, you know, those types of things, the better it is for our system, which then leads to better sleep. And with better sleep, we get to that point, stage three sleep, where our brain is able to start kind of cleansing itself and cleaning out some of the amyloid plaques and things that we see with dementia. So, you know, food is such an important part here. And now to have what you're telling us, it's even another element of how important food is.
Absolutely. I think it's so complex the way that the actual quality of what we're putting into our body makes sense that it would have a huge impact. Although I think even as you're saying, that's kind of new knowledge in a way. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this level of your mental and cognitive relationship to food and the way you're utilizing it mm-hmm. that also has a significant impact on your sleep. And so it's really, we really have to broaden our view of how we are looking at things that impact us and being open to observing ourselves in many ways, observing what we're putting into our body, but mm-hmm. observing also the way we feel about ourselves, the way we feel emotionally about different foods, and the ways that we are behaving in response to some of those feelings.
Yeah. And basically, I think, you know, ultimately, just like we talk about having a standardized wake time, a standardized sleep time, I think what you're saying is tied to that, a standardized breakfast, a standardized lunch, a standardized dinner. And wouldn't hurt if the foods that you're having at those times are more, you know, plant-based, more natural, less processed, et cetera.
Sure, absolutely. Really clocking in on that regularity and reminding yourself, my body needs food in the morning, even if I don't necessarily feel hungry, because my brain wants indicators as to what time it is.
Yeah. Well, this is a great time for us to take a break for a commercial. So I'm going to take a break and we'll be right back with Savannah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Types. Now I'm going to talk while I'm on break. I don't know what it is. I know I hear the hissing and all. Do you hear it on your side?
I do. I'm not sure if that's going to show up in the recording or not.
I'm going to say just ignore it. And at the end of the recording, I can apply some filters and it might filter it out.
Okay.
So hang on here. I'm going to bring us right back here now. All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Savannah Hypes. We just finished talking about food and how it impacts sleep. And now I'd really like to move on to another area. And Savannah, you know, tell us something that is really kind of like fun for you when it comes to working with sleep clients.
Oh, so much is fun about it. What's really cool is that sleep, even though there's these basic things that we know, like get out of bed at the same time and go to bed later and blah, 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 we know these things work. But for each unique person, it's different. So we have to tailor it to that person's unique experience. And that's something that I think is really fun that we get to do, is identifying like what are the tweaks to this that we have to make that's really going to like really going to get to the heart of like your, what's keeping you from good, deep rest. And part of that, that is really fun for me to talk about, is treating nightmares, which is just so exciting and creative, even though it's also can be like really terrifying and painful sometimes for people.
Right.
But I'm curious, is that an interest of yours or where are you at with nightmare treatment?
Yeah, you know, I find nightmares to be really interesting. And when I first was learning about them, you know, I had to find out, are there treatments for these things? And then to find out that there is treatment for nightmares and to learn the treatment was really interesting. But here's a question I have for you, because I haven't had the opportunity to research this yet. I know you work with a lot of different types of professionals, and I'm curious, do you run into one type of profession that tends to have more nightmares than another? Like you could have people who are out there that are first responders who see a lot of really gory stuff. You also have people who might be, you know, attorneys or accountants who work with really stressful stuff in a different way. Do you see nightmares more in one or the other, or is it just pretty much anybody?
No, I wouldn't say that it necessarily, like, all people in this certain profession have a likelihood towards nightmares. I do have a long history of working specifically with veterans as well, which is its own, you know, whole profession, active military duty and veterans. Mm-hmm. And of course, they do have a high propensity for nightmares, which is due to a lot of different factors. But I think what's curious to me, but probably also to you and your listeners about nightmares, is that it's not usually just the content in general about a nightmare that is frightening or painful. there's usually a piece of it that's really unique to the person that like kind of guts them about the nightmare. And it's different than you would expect. So I'm thinking of research that's been done around nightmares and the treatment of them. And when you put someone in an EEG and an MRI machine and you watch their brain waves and you watch different sections of their brain light up while they're having a nightmare, and then you wake them up and ask them to describe the nightmare to you, when you hear the nightmare, you're assuming, oh, that part that you described to me sounds the most horrific. That must be the part where your brain was lighting up and you're describing that it was really painful. Especially if there's a lot of violence in it or a lot of traumatic features to it, things that are very frightening. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes the person will say, no, that was fine. The part that was the worst was something like me feeling like I should have been able to, intervene in this situation. Or the part to me was that they called me ahead of time before all this violence happened. Like there's something that actually doesn't have to do with what we would think the scariest part is, mm-hmm. that is unique to each person who has a nightmare. And any of your listeners who've had a nightmare before can probably say this, that maybe they've described dreams they've had to other people. And the person might go, oh my gosh, this part was so scary. And you go, sure, I guess, but really the worst thing was this over here that like has meaning to me that you wouldn't see on the forefront.
Hmm. That's really interesting. And as you're talking about it, here's what I'm thinking to myself. I'm thinking, there's some people who have dreams, okay? And in their dream, maybe they feel like they're not in control of something or something went wrong or whatever. And then there's people that describe nightmares. And when I hear the word nightmare, I typically think of like gory, scary, really hyper type of stuff. Is there a difference between a nightmare and someone who has a dream where they're just not kind of feeling good about it?
Yes. There are anxiety dreams, which are usually those dreams where you wake up and you're like, oh, like that didn't feel so fun or that was really stressful. A nightmare is a dream that startles you awake, a dream that is painful or scary or uncomfortable in some way, but primarily that frightens you into waking up, and a dream that causes you to think about it during the day and start to feel like worried about going to sleep. You start to feel like you want to make sure that you don't dream that dream again because it was so painful. Plenty of people, one, have nightmares sporadically. That's normal. It's part of your brain's processing emotional information. Mm-hmm. But also plenty of people have anxiety dreams that are stressful, but you sleep through it. And when you sleep through the dream, your brain actually has the ability to like work through the ending, which typically is like how some trauma processing happens, is when mm-hmm. you can finish the dream, or at least you can sleep through it and it doesn't frighten you awake. Mm-hmm. But when it frightens you awake, you don't get the chance to finish it. And that often can be what causes your brain to return to it over and over. That's those chronic nightmares. It's not just once in a while. It's I continue to have dreams of this same theme over and over because there's something unfinished about it.
Yeah. See, now that's something I was going to ask you about, because I think it bears clarification for the audience. So, okay, what I'm hearing from you and from other guests that I've spoken with about nightmares, it sounds like if someone has a nightmare, something that actually wakes them up and has that nightmarish element to it, it sounds like it's the type of thing that they're going to have repeatedly over different nights. Or is that different, or how is it different than if somebody has like one night they have this, what they say, a nightmare, but then would they not have it again? How does that work?
Yeah, it's confusing because there's so many different ways the brain can conjure up images during the night that have different impacts on us. But mm-hmm. everybody has nightmares occasionally. So if it's once in a blue moon, that's usually not a problem. Just provide yourself some like kindness and self-compassion, and it usually won't return. But if you're having nightmares that recur, meaning that either it's the same story every time, or it's a completely different story every time, but usually there's something about the theme of it that's the same. Mm-hmm. Like, I continue to not be able to control my environment. in every dream. If it's a different environment every dream, but it's always the same sense of like, I'm out of control. Or it's always the same sense of I'm unsafe. This is dangerous. And the dream might look different, but it's always that same core theme.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be what I would say is a recurring nightmare. It could actually be the same thing over and over, or it could just be very similar themes that continue to recur. Some people have nightmares like this every night, multiple times a night. Sometimes they have it a couple times a week. And those are the people who really do best in getting nightmare treatment and find the most effectiveness from it and resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty normal to have once in a blue moon a nightmare. And that usually doesn't require treatment, just some self-care.
Okay. So now I want to kind of bring us full circle for a second. So you started off by saying that one of the things you enjoy about it is the creativity element that mm-hmm. you use. So now we have a better understanding of kind of nightmares and recurrent themes and, you know, versus like maybe an anxiety dream and all that. So now kind of tell us again, so what is the creativity element that you get to use in that treatment?
Yeah. Thanks for pulling me back, because this is the fun part.
Yeah.
That with nightmares, the treatment part, a big element of the treatment for it is us kind of writing out the nightmare, writing out the storyline, and identifying what are those key elements that are repetitive for you, whether it's a sense of safety, lack of safety, or it's a sense of self-esteem, like guilt, you're feeling bad about yourself, or whatever it is. We identify that like pain point, mm-hmm. and then we write a new version of the dream where a lot of the stuff is the same, but that pain point we take and we change in some way.
Okay.
And this is the fun part, because we get to be really creative with it, even though it's a painful thing to do. It kind of ends up being fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of similar to, if you're a Harry Potter fan or any of your listeners are, there's in one of the movies, there's what's called, oh, I can't remember the name of it, but it's in a closet. And it's a thing where as soon as it interacts with a person, it takes on the shape of whatever that person fears most.
Hmm.
And the way to defeat this being, spell, whatever it is, I forget, you have to imagine it as a funny version. So, for example, one of the characters, when it encounters them, it becomes a spider because the character's very afraid of spiders.
Right.
And then he imagines a funny version, something that takes away the pain of that image. He imagines the spider is wearing rollerblades and it starts slipping and sliding and it's like very comedic.
Right.
That's what we do with nightmares. We take something really painful. We identify kind of the pain piece about it for you that tends to recur in the theme.
Mm-hmm.
And then we change it. We make it funny, or we make it so that you suddenly have a superpower and you can control that element of the dream, so that by the end of the dream, you're not distressed about it anymore.
All right. So wait, let me make sure I get this right. So patient is sleeping. They have a nightmare. The nightmare involves this scary spider that mm-hmm. they're, you know, deathly afraid of. They come to you. They say, I'm having these nightmares. And then while they're awake in your office, you're rewriting the script of what happened. So if you do that in your office when you're awake, well, what happens when they go back to bed?
They don't usually dream the dream that we rewrote.
Okay.
But what happens is it gives their brain some relief around like the pain of that particular storyline. But it also gives their brain different images, because our brains are very routine. It's kind of like when you go on a hike, it's faster for you to go on the path that's been trailed a million times, right? You don't tend to bring a machete and forage your own way, because that is difficult and takes a long time.
Right.
Your brain and your neurons do the same thing. They tend to reach for images that you've already been familiar with and have seen a million times. So if you've dreamt a certain theme of distressing dream, when you go to bed, your brain is just going to reach for that automatically. And by us rewriting it and making it different and practicing bringing the different image to mind, mm-hmm. we're giving the brain some other options so that it's able to have some like newness, as opposed to going back to that same old painful theme every time. So you usually won't dream the new thing, but you'll dream something totally different and you won't feel distressed about it. You'll be like, oh, that was weird, but I don't feel afraid.
So for someone who is in treatment for nightmares and they go through that, what's the long-term impact then? Like, why don't they just have a different nightmare the next night?
Because you learn the skill. Like, you start to fear your nightmares less because you feel a sense of empowerment over it. You go, oh, it's scary in the moment, but it's actually not that bad because now I know I just addressed the painful thing by changing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that your brain kind of latches on to that new skill. So you do it once with the therapist. And if you have a couple of different kinds of recurring dreams, maybe you do it again for the different dream. But once you've done that and you've kind of gotten that skill, gotten your brain comfortable with it and increased your own sense of confidence over the nightmare experience,
mm-hmm.
your brain tends to be able to just kind of do that automatically. And it doesn't tend to continue to have nightmares, even if you have maybe something different occurs in your life in the future and you do experience a new nightmare. Oftentimes it won't last very long, or you will be able to just do the same process on your own without the therapist because now you know how to do it. And then the nightmare will dissipate.
Fantastic. Really interesting stuff here. Well, we're at a point where I need to take another commercial break. So bear with us as we do a little bit of business here, and we will be right back with Savannah Heights.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Savannah Heights. We just talked about nightmares, and I'd like to move forward a little bit here. And let's talk about, you know, with all the different types of clients that you see, have you recognized any sort of differences in personality types that might have different types of issues? What do you actually see, you know, as a practitioner sharing with the audience, what comes into your office?
Yeah, I tend to get a lot of very like rigid, routined people, mm-hmm. which you would think would be helpful for sleep, right? Like waking up at the same time every day, going to bed. Like you would think that that kind of rigidity and routine would be really effective. But for some people, it kind of gets them like locked into a certain way of thinking and being, and they have difficulty kind of finding flexibility and coming out of that. Mm. So that might look like having really rigid beliefs about how much sleep they need.
Mm-hmm.
That might look like kind of constantly overthinking things because they're used to things always being a certain way. And if that changes, they feel like there's something wrong. And so they kind of overthink a situation. And when you overthink something, you're kind of creating a sense of arousal, heightened arousal in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to prevent you from sleeping. So that sense of rigidity and really heightened physiological arousal tends to be a really common factor that is not really a bad thing in your life. There's pros and cons to every personality characteristic, but that one does tend to impact sleep quite a bit.
Oh, okay. So as you're talking about that, I'm thinking to myself about clients that I have. And the first thing that came to mind is number one, I have a lot of clients who are always looking for that mythical perfection that doesn't mm-hmm. exist. And that causes a lot of distress for them. But I'm also thinking about people who might be on the autism spectrum looking for that rigid schedule and things like that. Do you see any sort of uptick in people who might be on the autism spectrum and sleep issues, or talk about some of the different types of personality types that lead to this?
That's a really interesting question. And I haven't worked with a whole lot of people who've been on the spectrum specifically for insomnia, but I think that's a really valid thing maybe to research if it hasn't been done in the research yet.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we know that people on the spectrum are hugely under-researched, especially women and women of color. Most of the research on ASD is white males.
Oh.
So there's a lot, there's a huge lack of information that we have about that population, which is why there's a whole lot of recent diagnoses that we're seeing come into play in society right now, just because we didn't have the research in the past to recognize symptoms and how they show up in women and women of color.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's kind of a side note and tangent there. But what I do frequently experience in terms of different personality types is that kind of overthinking can be problematic with sleep, but also it can be really useful in your life. And what comes to mind for me is tech workers in particular, people who work in the tech industry, they have what I would call a tinker brain. A brain that likes to turn a problem over and over and over until it finds the right solution.
Mm-hmm.
Often very perfectionistic, like you mentioned. And this works really well for them in their life. It's super functional and effective on the day-to-day for them to be able to isolate a problem and review it so many times that they can get down to the detail. Like coders, for instance, they have to review a code over and over and over, and there's always some little tiny tweak that is making it a huge problem in the program.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really great personality to have as a tech worker, to have a brain that's going to be tinkering with things and kind of obsessing about a problem. And this also leads them to be very creative. They often have big ideas that they end up laying awake with at night going, oh, like, what's the one thing I need to do to make that code work? Or how could we use this, you know, particular program? Like, they have lots of really fun, creative ideas, which is great, but sometimes leads them to be excited and awake in the middle of the night. So that's something that I often see, that maybe we don't need to problematize. Like, we don't need to call that a problem because it's actually really useful for them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some cons that we should be aware of, like it is going to impact how they sleep and the timing of that.
Right. You know, it's interesting because as you were talking about tech worker, I'm thinking to myself, that profession really is half of the more strict and rigid, but it's also half of the very creative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, you know, I was trying to think, you know, to myself, maybe, and this is just because of my background, I think of lawyers as more rigid because they're tied to the written law, the case law, the very, you know, rigid that way. There's not a, I mean, yes, there's room for creativity, but not the same way. And then on the other side, I think of like artists, people who can create amazing art, nothing that I could ever even imagine or do, but they just have the brain to do it. Do you see any people on either side of that spectrum?
Yeah, that's great. I think tech workers fall right in the middle, that they have so much technical knowledge and rules, you know, that make technology work, but they also have to apply it in a really outside of the box way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would say like people in the military are more on the rigid end versus, and like people in healthcare often are that same way, which hugely impacts their sleep, especially because they unfortunately have to stick to these schedules that are not appropriate for their sleep. And then there's people on the other end who, like musicians and creatives and other people there who, this is, okay, I didn't plan to talk about this, but this is exciting because there's a big stigma around when you sleep.
Okay.
There's a huge stigma with people who their natural circadian rhythm prefers to sleep in the late hours of the morning, right? People who are creative and have these tinker brains and these creative minds tend to be up in the middle of the night creating. And then they sleep late into the morning. And then they have a sense of shame that they are not productive or that society is looking down on them. And I've experienced this many times with people who come to me and have a sense of shame about the timing of their sleep.
Hmm.
When really it's effective for them to sleep within the window that their brain prefers. And we need to get flexible with that and recognize that, yes, our society kind of set things up that we work from 9 to 5, but that it doesn't have to be that way. And that's actually not the time of day where some people in our population are the most alert and effective at their job.
Right.
Tech workers in particular, I actually did an interview series where I asked people who work in the tech industry who have trouble sleeping to talk to me and let me interview them. And many of them have a sense of irregularity with their schedule. One, because they tend to sleep later into the morning, and their job also requires them to do system updates in the middle of the night when other people are not utilizing certain programs.
Right, right.
And that works really well for them, and yet they still have a sense of shame about it, and as if they are like lesser, and they overcompensate for that by working harder and longer hours, which ends up really sleep depriving them because they're trying to hold themselves to the standard that doesn't need to be a requirement for them.
Right, right. Wow. Yeah, I, you know, for myself, I'm just thinking about, you know, throughout my career, I would say it feels like anyway, the majority of people that I work with are morning people. That they're up at the crack of dawn and they're ready to go and they're just zoom, 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 zoom. I have always been a night person. If I have a big project to do or something that's complex and takes a lot of thought, I will wait until the evening because my brain turns on at that time and I can sit there and I can go for hours with really difficult stuff at night. But ask me to do it in the morning, it's not going to happen. I just can't. It's like my brain hasn't turned on yet.
Exactly. And I think this is a big barrier to people getting the sleep treatment that they need. Because I have people who come to me and they are morning people and they have no shame about coming in and saying, hey, I've tried getting up in the morning and it's not, you know, there's still something not working for me. Can you help me? But the people who are unable to regularly get themselves up in the early morning, as, you know, all of the books say that they should do and all of their friends and their parents say that they should do, those people have a sense of, oh, like, I know what I need to do. I just can't do it. So there's no use in asking my health provider for help.
Right.
When really there's a huge likely circadian difference happening for them. And it may not be that they need to force themselves to wake up in the morning. It may be that they need to change other things about their routine and their schedule to make their sleep more effective. Mm-hmm. And they're never going to be open to that until they come talk to a sleep specialist about it.
Right.
They often don't because they have this sense of shame of like, oh, I already know what I need to do and I just can't do it. And that's my own moral issue. It becomes a moral issue for some people. And that just, I hate that.
Yeah.
That something in your health that should, you know, health is like a common need for all people. It's a human, you know, right to receive appropriate healthcare. And yet many people remove that option from themselves because they feel they have some moral failing related to their health.
Right, right. Wow. Well, we are actually out of time for this episode. So, Savannah Hypes, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to share with our audience all these interesting facts about sleep and professionals and anxiety. You know, there's so much here. It's not, you know, when I tell people I work with sleep, they're like, well, what is there to do? You go to sleep and you wake up and that's it. And I said, well, it's a little bit more than that. So, but thank you for your time. We appreciate it. And we wish you the best with all of your clients.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.